I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government.
The biggest political story, the biggest Washington story of 2019 might not be happening in Washington at all. It could be this, the prospects of a world economic slowdown.
We have the U.S. sort of coming back to earth after an exceptional period of growth, and then no one really picking up the slack outside the U.S.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Some good news to start out your weekend. The government shutdown coming to an end, at least for 3 weeks. That happening on Friday. And another major news development, the Fed is thinking about dialing back its position on QT. Could tightening be coming to an end? Hi, everybody. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Ralph Ancampora will be joining us. He's taking a look at, if you look at the Dow theory, which is Papa Dow is one of the oldest technical theories out there, well, it says we're in a bear market. So you're going to want to hear what Ralph has to say about that. Robert Rapier will also be joining me in the second half of the first hour as he talks about his forecast, brace yourself, $70 oil, and he has some pretty strong thoughts on that. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week, a lot of action that we're seeing politically, economically, all of that coming up in Hour 1.
And in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss the approaching debt tsunami. We received an email from a listener that asked about BBB bonds and what would happen to individual bondholders if those bonds were to be downgraded. So we'll take some time in Hour 2 to discuss the consequences of that happening. We also talk about the leveraged loan market, since it too has exploded, doubling in size over the past decade. We also spend time discussing credit default swaps and what we see happening with global synchronization. So be sure to stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture. And now we turn to Ryan Poplava to go over the major catalysts that moved the market this week.
You know, it was an interesting week in earnings because under normal circumstances, I think the bulls would have had a successful week due to a positive reaction to semiconductor earnings and some Dow big names like Big Blue, IBM, United Technologies, and Procter & Gamble. Let's talk about that first, and then I'll give you two reasons why the market didn't go better than it could have. Now, starting off with IBM, they beat earnings by 5 cents, raised this year's guidance on earnings by 10 cents to about $13.90. Though their revenues were down about 3.5% year over year. About a week ago, Red Hat's 8K filing showed its shareholders approved the deal. And several firms increased their price target on IBM. They did exceptionally well in their cloud computing. And it's just looking like things are kind of holding steady and turning around. And that has a lot of Wall Street very excited about that for IBM, really branching out into cloud computing. Now, United Technologies beat earnings as well. They killed it. They beat earnings by 42 cents and crushed revenues up 15%. Now, on the call, they said their segment profit is expected to grow faster than sales. And they also said that their free cash flow is expected to outpace earnings. Now, Procter & Gamble, another big name in the Dow, same day, was interesting. They said China revenues were up 15% and India was up 16%. And specifically, they were looking also at their e-commerce organic sales were up around 30%. And what was very interesting about their call is they said that they see no sign of slowdown in China, at least for them in consumer products. So looking at the semiconductors, which have a leading indicator status given their wide use in industrial applications, we have Lam Research, Xilinx, Teradyne, and Texas Instruments all up after the reports of better-than-feared guidance and better-than-expected earnings. Now, I dug in a little bit to the Texas Instruments earnings and found that while industrial and automotive declined in the quarter, communication sales were up 20% ahead of 5G. You know, a lot of investment going into that right now. And that has real positive implications for Qualcomm, Broadcom, Nokia, Juniper, and Xilinx. Now, let's take a look at the two reasons I said I think why we weren't up even more than we could have. I think the first one is we really have to kind of check ourselves with how the market has been technically overbought here. I've read several technical pieces this week from very big names, Pring Murphy and Art Hill, many on the that come on the show, and more, who all have the opinion that a second bottom may still be needed, or at least a higher low, before we can really kind of rewind this whole idea of we're in a long-term downtrend right now. We've got lower highs and lower lows. And right now, the market has run up against that same long-term resistance. Now, at one point, the market was up 13% from the lows in as little as a month. So it's not surprising to see a bit of a cap on positive news right now. Now, secondly, we still have bearish economic news coming in this week. On Tuesday, the market reacted negatively to new news that China's growth is slowing, with their GDP only up 6.6% for 2018. Now, the IMF cut its 2019 global forecast down to 3.5% for 2019 and 3.6% in 2020. Now, on the heels of the reported decline in Chinese exports, which we talked about last week, Japan reported a 3.8% decline in exports, which came from its flash PMI report. Now, speaking of the PMIs, the U.S. decelerated in manufacturing and services, as did Europe. Now, Europe was down to 50.5. Anytime you see a reading of 50, that's flat. So we're basically barely moving the needle right now in manufacturing. And Japan was down to flat at 50. Yet the bears were unable to break this rally strength on that news. If they were going to do it, I think they should have done it on that news. Now, to finish this week, I read a Wall Street Journal article that the Federal Reserve may be getting close to the end of its balance sheet normalization. Now, stating further that they will maintain a larger size balance sheet than it expected when it began quantitative tightening. Well, we already knew as much from previously hearing from Powell's comments this month. But it was interesting because while stocks were basically flat through the volatility this week, commodities had a great run on the balance sheet news. Finally, this week at the end, President Trump announced a short-term deal to fund the government until February 15th, which came shortly after a shortage of air traffic controllers caused the Aviation Administration to halt flights in LaGuardia Airport in New York. Now, it's thought if an agreement isn't met, he may just move forward with the national emergency funding. It was interesting, though, we would have thought some sort of deal, we would have seen the market really rebound. But since that news, the market has pulled back.
Well, Ryan, with that three-week reprieve, hopefully we'll see more of a rebound as the economy hopefully gets on better footing. In the meantime, Ryan, thank you so much for that report, and we'll look forward to having you in the studio next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Ask an economist if we're going to go into a recession, and they'll say, look at GDP, look at jobs, look at retail sales, look at the industrial production, the economy's fine. To which I would respond, those are not the measures that tell you you're in a recession. You have to look at who's going to murder the economy. I've used the analogy of I'm in the Situation Room watching soldiers on a firefight, and I can see their biometrics. Hey, their heart rates are fine. Their blood pressures are fine. And then they get hit with a bullet and they're dead. And that's exactly what we're doing. Hey, the blood pressure and the heart rate of the economy is fine. I'm worried it's going to get bullet in the head by the Federal Reserve, murdered by the Federal Reserve. And they do it on the idea that they need to fight inflation, and they raise rates too much. And this signal that they've done too much is the yield curve inverting. We were really close to having it invert back in late December, early January. That doesn't mean it's over. I still think that later this year, we could see the yield curve invert. And what should that tell you? The Fed is too tight. They're going to cause a recession. You can stop looking at GDP and payrolls. They're going to shoot it, is what they're going to do. And that's why you have a recession. A business cycle can continue forever, meaning we can have an expansion that continues forever. Why don't we? Because somebody or something breaks it. And that's what you have to look at when you want to worry about a recession.
Another good week, at least it's looking that way on this Thursday, as stocks are up and they are in positive territory for the year. But will they remain there? So we have some big questions. Is this a bull market, a bear market, or just a trading range? Joining me on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, I guess let's begin with the first question. Bull, bear, or is this just a trading range?
If you look at the oldest theory in technical analysis, Dow theory, as I interpret it, we got a bear market signal when the market collapsed in December, when both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Dow Jones Transportation Average broke below their 2018 lows on a closing basis. And what you have since the December low, the Christmas time bottom, that's been a rally. If you follow Dow theory, that's been a rally in a bear market. I look at that as a macro thing. It isn't something I pound the table and I totally follow, but it's to answer your question, that's that theory. Now, I think we've made an important low in December, and I call it a vacuum rally, this kickback rally that we've had in the last several weeks. There is no supply between here and the low until a couple of days ago, and I think you're going to a trading range. So to answer your question, I think we're in a trading range right now.
Ralph, what does this do? And perhaps you can explain to our listeners, when we got that first correction in February of last year, we were week after week in January, the stock prices were going up, the stimulus was kicking in, government spending, everybody was very optimistic. In 6 days, we gave it all back, and we sort of kind of went sideways for a little bit, but then we headed up and to those new highs leading into October. But this time around, it's been a little different. Explain for our listeners, psychologically, when you see the charts, drop off a cliff, and very suddenly, what that does to investor psychology?
Well, it surely makes people step back, especially and fearfully step back, especially if you've been following the market for the last 9 years. I mean, coming out of the March to 2009 low, we've had a buy hold market and we haven't had the volatility. What we've initiated starting in early 2018 is a very volatile market, and many people are not used to this. And this volatility necessitates, by definition, that you have to be more selective. Many people have lulled into a full sense of security to be a passive investor. And now I think we're going to realize that it pays to be a little bit more aggressive, or at least using timely tools like technical analysis. I want to say that the early decline in 2018 is a lot different than the decline we just went through this time around. And the reason why I say that is the FANG stocks, which was a big part of the leadership, just literally got crushed. The last time I've ever seen anything like that, believe it or not, and I'm an old man, so I can go back in time, was in the early 1970s, 1973, 74, was the end of the Nifty 50 era. And they crushed those stocks. There were 50 stocks that all the institutions owned, and the breadth of the market was terrible in those days. And I think we saw a little bit of that. So I think you're going to lose some followers, like people who have just bought and held Apple, for example. I think they're going to be a little more tentative and a little bit more cautious going forward.
So what you're looking at a market like this that abruptly falls, and I think, given the fundamentals, earnings were going up, the economy was growing, nobody expected this. I guess if we look at Dow theory, which is, as you mentioned, a macro thing, and you could say, well, we're in a trading range. When you're looking at this, Ralph, is there any technical tool that you kind of rely on with your experience that really gives you sort of like a definitive outlook in terms of where the market might be heading?
There are two indicators that I look at. They're very simple. Everybody can dial them up. It's the RSI and the MACD. And I like them not so much on a daily basis. I like them on a weekly basis. And that gives me an intermediate term view as opposed to the short term view. And if you were able to dial it up and go back to early part of 2018 and see that we were very overbought then. And then when we went back in October of 2018, you could see those indicators were not at the same level. So they were saying early on that it's different. There was a different rally. The momentum was not there. I don't see that positive divergence just yet on those indicators on a weekly basis, but I'll be looking for them as time evolves. So those are the things I look at. And then I keep a, this is something that was told to me many, many years ago when I was a young analyst, and the old time technicians would wave their finger at me and say, never fight Papa Dow. And I do this study twice a year. I call it my what if study. Anyone can do this. You take a look at the 30 Dow stocks, and there are only 30 of them. You know, everybody laughs at the Dow because it's an arithmetic average. I don't laugh at the Dow because an arithmetic average allows me to be able to work with the numbers. And I calculate near-term rallies, major rallies, near-term declines, and major declines for all 30 stocks. So I have four columns of numbers. I add up these separate columns, and I divide by the current divisor, and I'll get a target. Now, I call it what if, because what if all the stocks were to hit Ralph's near-term targets? What would be the Dow's objective? And of course, they're not all going to get there. But sometimes when you have a very exuberant move up or down, you're going to see these levels hit. And what it does is put blinkers on my eyes and prevents me from becoming very, very bearish or very, very bullish. And it's a reality test for me. I do it in January before the new year starts, and I do it in June. Mid-year, just to see how my targets are doing.
You know, that's really sort of insightful, because what it tells you, and our listeners may not be aware of, is the Dow is price-weighted and the S&P is market cap-weighted. So at times when the markets are going up, and you see this towards the end of a bull market, the generals are leading. So the indexes are going up, which seems like times are good, but it's only a handful of stocks of doing it. What you're saying is, remove all these weightings and just look at the stocks themselves, and it gives you a truer picture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And it's when I did it last, my extreme bullish upside target, okay, is the Dow making a slight new high, about 27,000. That's everything going great. My extreme bearish downside, everything just falling apart, is around 18,000, I'll say 18,500. So those are my extremes. But in the middle, I have this trading range. I'm in the camp of saying we've had a vacuum. I like to use the word a vacuum rally, you know, coming off the December lows. It was like stretching a rubber band and keeping it taut and letting one end go and snap back rally. That's what we just witnessed. Now, for the first time, we're running into overhead supply. And then and that was the October-November period when we were consolidating. Remember, the Dow was churning at around 25,000, 26,000 level and then fell out a bit. Well, that's what we're encountering now. And I think it's normal what the market's doing. Today, it's pulling back. I think when people say, well, we need a retest, well, that doesn't mean you have to go all the way back to 21,700, 800, where the intraday low on the Dow was recently. But, you know, just get a pullback, you know, a few hundred points from here. I would be very happy with that. And, oh, by the way, Dow theory, if you get a pullback and one or both of the Dow Industrial Transmission, one or both of these averages does not make a new low, then you have positive non-confirmation. That could be the beginning of a return back to a bullish phase.
Now, here's an interesting concept. We discussed this a while back, last time I had you on the program, but it kind of hit me again. I was watching one of the cable financial shows, and one of the anchors had a large position in Microsoft, and had owned it for quite a while and had significant capital gains. And one of the analysts he was interviewing, he asked him about technology. And he said, what should I do with my Microsoft? He said, you know, I'd be taking profits. And then the anchor said something that I thought perceptively that was kind of smart. He said, well, if I do that, I'm going to have my own bear market. It's called taxes. I'll lose a third of my gains.
Yes, that's right. You got to be careful with again, it's the perspective people have. I mean, if your objective is to be long-term and enjoy the dividends and your capital gains, et cetera, you have to take that into consideration and try to project your worst-case downside. And if you can live with that, come on, the world's not going to come to an end. We'll get the resumption of a rally. But I think we're in a slightly different environment this time around. I shouldn't say slightly different, a very different environment. I think it's going to be very, very volatile. So people have to adjust to that.
And Ralph, the things that can make this very volatile, you've got politics going on. You've got a Fed rate raising cycle. I think last time you spoke, the real trouble, at least from your perspective, doesn't really start until we start getting interest rates in the 4 or 5% range. Do you still hold that view given this environment?
Oh, well, that's the direction of long-term interest rates. Oh, yes. Yes. But the noise that we have around the market now, I mean, come on, you've got this thing with China and tariffs. These politicians that we have, if it were up to me, I'd fire them all and start all over again. I mean, with clothes, come on, this is nonsense. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. Look in the mirror. We should be embarrassed to be living through this nonsense in Washington. I mean, come on. I'm going to get upset. But I think there are a lot of. But by the way, no one's talking. Draghi came out apparently today. But if you go look at the DAX index, boy, that looks awfully toppy, and it has looked awfully toppy, massive head and shoulder top for a long, long time. I look at globally. You want to see? Go look at the weekly chart on EEM emerging markets. That's probably one of the better looking charts around the world. And only because it just got absolutely crushed all of last year and early this year and appears to be bottoming out.
Yeah, it looks like it is kind of lifting up. You know, as you've been in these markets for a long period of time, is there any time?
52 years.
52 years. That's a lot of wisdom.
Yes.
And a lot of experience.
I hope so. And a lot of scars, I got to tell you.
You learned those the hard way. Ralph, is there any market that really stands out to you or any nuggets of wisdom? You know, Bob Farrell used to have a couple rules out there. What about some Ralph Acampora rules?
You would think that Ralph Acampora, who loves technical analysis and did an awful lot to get the subject recognized by the Securities Exchange Commission, along with other my buddies in New York, you would think with the certification exam that we now have, the CMT designation, which is our version of the CFA, and I encourage everybody to take it. Now, having said that, you would think that I would be excited listening to all these talking heads on television talking about moving averages and Fibonacci Liberace numbers and, oh, they got all these things going. And you would think that I would be happy. Well, I am that technical is getting more exposure. But number one, I question whether the viewing audience truly understands what they're talking about, number one. And number two, I question whether these guys know what they're talking about. So if it were up to me, I would encourage people to take that CMT exam because, number one, it's going to force you to read all the right books. And it's going to force you to, by the way, that exam is created around a survey that's taken every couple of years of all the members of this organization, the CMT Association. And if 10% of the organization uses Elliott Wave, guess what? 10% of that is going to be on the exam. So in other words, the current upbeat opinion of what the community thinks of the subject and what is most urgently needed in the subject for them now. And I would encourage people to do that.
Is that one of the things that you're proudest of, Ralph? Because I know you were a significant player in getting the authorities to recognize the validity of technical analysis. Because up until, you know, you had something like the CMT, it was kind of looked as kind of strange stuff out there.
The most important date in modern technical analysis history is Friday, December 17, 2004, when myself and a small band of technicians went in front of about 10, 11 SEC lawyers at the New York Stock Exchange. And one of my buddies spoke 3 minutes on the history of the subject, dating back to Charles Dow, et cetera. Second fellow spoke 3 minutes on the history of the organization. It was called the Market Technicians Association at the time. They recently changed their name. And the third fellow talked 3 minutes on the history of the exam itself, the CMT exam. And I got up and I had the last 5 minutes. I had the closing comments. And I said to these lawyers, and by the way, this was in response to the Sarbanes-Oxley law that came out in 2004. And the Sarbanes-Oxley law said that all analysts had to take two tests, Series 86 and 87. 87 was new rules and regulations. No problems with that. We all had to take that. But 86, I had to have the equivalency of levels 1 and 2 of the CFA. And here I was an analyst for over 40 years, and I just was livid. And I told the organization, give me all the money in your treasury. You're going to throw it at this problem. If we don't win, we don't represent anybody. We don't have the ability to represent anybody. And that was the gist of that meeting. By the way, it was a whole year of negotiating with the authorities. Anyway, I get up and I said to these lawyers, I said, imagine if tomorrow morning you lawyers were being mandated to take the medical board. You're looking at me like I'm crazy. I said, assuming you could pass the medical boards, you wouldn't use that body of knowledge in your daily work as lawyers. And they're all nodding their head, yes. I said, well, that's what you're asking me to do. Please test me, but test me on my body of knowledge. Well, one of the lawyers jumps up and says, oh, Ralphie, we see you on television. You're a nice guy. And he shoves a chart in my face. And my knees are like rubber. I said, oh, my God, he's asking me a question. He said, what's fact on this chart? I looked at the chart and I stared at him straight in his face. And I said, price is a fact. And his eyes got wide open. And with that, I put my finger down on his chest and I'm pounding on his chest with my finger. And I said, earnings are an estimate. You restate earnings. You never restate this chart. And the man says, wow, that's the best answer I've ever heard. And I said, you better believe it. And that's how the meeting ended. And March, about 3-4 months later, March 2005, the SEC approved the CMT exam. It's equivalent to the CFA. Isn't that wonderful? Yes, I am most proud of that. Yes, that's the highlight of my career.
Well, you know, that's one thing that I eventually learned to do. I grew up on the fundamental side and then finally picked up on the technical. And I owe a lot of that to you and my own son, who's a CMT. And I just want to let our listeners know the reading material for the CMT levels 1, 2, and 3 are available in a book form, the readings, and you can pick them up on Amazon. Ralph, as we close, advice to investors, given that you think we're probably in a trading range, if I'm understanding you correctly, what would you be doing here?
I got to tell you something personally that I'm involved in family funds I advise. They're in Europe and one's in Saudi Arabia. And I'm not bragging or anything, but I got everybody out. Not, you know, I raised as much cash as I could. In some cases, it was a lot of cash in early October as the market started to unwind. And I'll be brutally honest. I said, I never got anybody back in with this rally. And I was tempted to do it. And I called up the families and I said, listen, you know, coming out of the lows here a few weeks ago, I said, if you're willing to start to accumulate some nice positions, you know, real names, you quality names, but we're willing, in the event that we have another reaction or another leg down, willing to add to those positions. So I humbly say to everybody, if you're a long-term investor, start looking. I would nibble. Don't take big positions here. I mean, I like Texas Instruments. Semi's had a pretty nice day today. And some of them look very, very interesting. I mentioned the emerging markets before. EEM you can start to slowly accumulate, but don't take your entire position because I really believe we're going to be very choppy here. And if we get the sell-off and the XLF is the finance is a little bit ahead of itself short-term, but if it pulls back, I would add to it. That would be my advice. And if you're a trader, go for it. But by all means, watch those trends and keep close stops.
Well, Ralph, always great advice. Great to have you back on the program. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year and great health to both you and your lovely wife.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I think that when it comes to illegal immigration, it would make a huge difference if law enforcement would start going after and prosecuting the people that are hiring these illegal aliens. This would help to cut down on the demand. It would cut down in the flow of immigrants across the border. And then that would allow ICE and CPB to really focus on the criminal aliens, the truly bad people. What's happening right now is we're seeing Border Patrol and ICE have to expend a lot of energy dealing with these economic migrants, with these young families that are coming through. And that really diverts them from the very important job of going after the criminal aliens, you know, the drug smugglers, the human traffickers. So there really are, you know, holistic things that need to be addressed here. And it just can't be focused, obviously, on a wall.
Well, here we are since December 24th. The price of oil is up over 25%.
Who would have thought it would drop 40% in a little over 3 weeks, be up 25%. A bull, a bear, and then a bull market again. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, I want to get right to it. I want to get to your predictions for 2019. Wall Street analysts have scaled back where they think WTI and Brent are going to be this year. Obviously much lower after the events in the last quarter of last year. In your 2019 predictions, you're talking about a rise of $25 a barrel in 2019, where we get maybe up to the $70 a barrel. What is going to be the driver of that, in your opinion?
There are a couple of pretty large drivers. The single biggest driver is probably OPEC and whether they maintain discipline in their production cuts. We were at this level 6 months ago until, you know, a trade war with China, and then President Trump allowed Iran to continue to export oil, and that kind of torpedoed the oil price, the level they were at. It torpedoed them going into the end of the year. But then, OPEC announced production cuts. Saudi Arabia actually came out and said, we've already cut production more than our commitments. And I think the market is seeing that they're pretty serious. You know, the last time they got serious about production cuts is that's when oil prices recovered a couple of years ago. So as long as they maintain discipline, but then another important piece of that is the waivers on Iran will run out in the next 3 months. I think they got a six-month waiver, countries did, to continue to import Iranian oil. And the Trump administration has said that's a one-time thing. Now, if that is, in fact, a one-time thing, then that's further bullishness for oil prices. But if they allow countries another waiver, and, you know, the reason they blinked last time is because oil prices had started to rise and they were concerned going into the election that, Iran's oil coming off the market could really bump oil prices up significantly. But if they don't blink this time, then you will see oil prices rise on up probably into the $60 range. And if OPEC maintains their production cuts, Russia stays on board as they've said they were going to, then I think we'll see $70 this year.
Wouldn't there be a loss of credibility if they granted waivers again? I mean, who would take the president serious?
Yeah, and that's one of the problems with Saudi Arabia right now is they got burned. They got talked into increasing production ahead of those waivers because they thought that Iranian oil is going to come off the market. So they bumped up production by, you know, 1 million barrels a day or so. And then suddenly Iran is allowed to continue to put their oil on the market. So there's too much oil on the market in the last quarter of last year. And I think the Saudis felt double crossed. And I think they will be a lot more careful this time around. And I think they will actually plan as a worst case scenario that that Iranian oil does stay on the market. So I don't think President Trump is going to be able to twist their arm this time and get them to bump up production.
Robert, let's talk about something else that may factor in here. Last time I had you on the program, we were talking about one of the reasons inventories increased as a result of the trade wars. You talked about China was buying less oil or stopped buying oil from the U.S. I think the figure you threw out was somewhere like 500,000 barrels a day. If we reach a trade agreement with China, they've already said they're going to buy more U.S. soybeans. If they go back to buying more oil, let's say they go back to buying 500,000 barrels a day, wouldn't that help to deplete these inventories rather rapidly?
Yes, that was the issue last summer. They had gotten up to 500,000 barrels a day. They were quickly becoming one of our most important export customers. And then the trade war completely shut that all the way down to zero. Now, recently, there was a tender that went to China. So they have imported U.S. oil for the first time in several months. And if that continues, you'll see U.S. inventories, which are in pretty healthy condition right now, they're a little bit above the five-year normal, you'll see U.S. inventories start to come back down. But, you know, on the other hand, U.S. production is probably 500,000 barrels a day higher than it was last summer. So, that's another factor here. U.S. oil production continues to rise at such a rapid rate that it's really causing problems for these guys around the world that are trying to keep the market balanced. I mean, we are 2 million barrels a day higher than we were a year ago. And that is after, several years of adding 1 million barrels a day year after year after year.
You and I were talking about the implications of that before we went on the air. So if U.S. production is up 2 million barrels a day, how long can that continue to increase, I guess, would be one question. And number two, if it does continue to increase at this magnitude, what does this do to OPEC's power to set prices or influence the market?
So if you look long term, I don't know how long this can go on, but if it can go on for, let's say, 10 years. 10 years is probably about the time that electric vehicles are going to start to take a serious bite out of oil demand. And so if the U.S. can continue to increase oil production for the next 10 years, it's going to ruin OPEC, because OPEC can continue to cut production to try to manage supply and demand. And if U.S. shale production peaked in the next, you know, 2-3 years, OPEC would be right back in the driver's seat. But if they continue to cut production and the U.S. continues to just match that production cut with a production increase, OPEC is not going to have any control over the market right up until the time that electric vehicles really start to hammer the oil markets, which I think is probably about a decade away. And so OPEC will be ruined. I mean, I think they still today have significant pricing power, because they still, you know, OPEC and Russia still produce more than 50% of the world's oil. But nobody wants to make these huge production cuts, and they may be able to make them for a couple of years. But, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of this, and I think OPEC is going to be completely ruined. They're not going to be able to manage the global oil markets anymore, because the production cuts they will have to make are just going to cut too deeply.
You know, there's a number of things that may be reinforcing this concept that you just mentioned. One is Prince Salman's goals of diversifying away from oil. He's inviting leaders from Silicon Valley to open up centers, data centers, and trying to get technology into the country. In other words, he's trying to move away from oil. That was number one. And secondly, recently you had Exxon announced that they were thinking of getting into electric car infrastructure. In other words, you know, instead of a gas station, they may be opening up charging stations. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, I think they can see the handwriting on the wall. I mean, they are sitting on something like 70% of the world's proved reserves, and they may not ever be able to produce those reserves. And so that's another thing about the production cuts. If they have to cut production going into the next 10 years, this may be stranded oil reserves. And I think there's a realization of that. And so this is going to be the big debate with OPEC. If electric cars continue to rise at the rate they've risen, and most people think that, you know, even the major oil companies are thinking that there's going to come a time, you know, maybe a decade or so out, that electric vehicles are going to start to do to the oil market what renewables and natural gas did to the coal market. And so there is a contingent within OPEC that would like to get those reserves produced, or they're going to be, you know, just sitting underground and not doing them any good financially.
Robert, what about the other uses of oil? And I want to talk about the transportation sector. So let's say we go to electric cars. What about trucks, trains, and ships? And, you know, airplanes, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine a 787 with 300 something passengers flying in the air on batteries.
Yeah. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. You know, Nova did a special on this this solar powered airplane that flew around the world a few years ago. And man, I mean, if there was any wind, if there was any cloud cover, I mean, things had to be absolutely perfect. And this thing was huge for one passenger. And the fact is, they just can't get the energy density in a battery, in solar cells. I think you're right. I think that will always rely on fossil fuels or some energy dense liquid fuel to power airplanes. And that'll probably be, you know, the case with marine shipping and a lot of things. But, you know, if transportation, personal transportation stops relying so much on gasoline, on diesel, that'll have a significant impact on crude oil demand around the world. I mean, that is a substantial portion of crude oil demand. Now, there are still, you know, the petrochemicals industry, plastics and so forth, but it will, you know, crude oil demand will pull back if electric vehicles become the preferred option for consumers to drive around, personal transportation.
So if you were, let's say, the executive of BP, Chevron, or Exxon, what are you thinking right now, given the subjects we just talked about?
Yeah, if I was them, I would be diversifying. I think natural gas now has a very, you know, bright future, and I think Shell has made the right moves there. You know, even in the power sector, where, you know, solar and wind have made major inroads, natural gas has made the most inroads there. And even if we go to a society that's largely powered on, you know, solar power and wind, natural gas is still going to be counted on to smooth out the intermittency of those. So I see natural gas playing a very, very important role over, you know, for the next 3-4 decades, whereas oil is going to continue to play a very important role for at least another 10 years. And then I think it will play a less important role than it plays. It won't continue to be a growth area, whereas natural gas, I think, is going to grow probably through 2050. And I can't say that about oil. I can say that oil probably grows, you know, another decade, but, you know, sometime in the 2030 to 2040 range, I think crude oil demand does start to peak, assuming production doesn't peak before then. I mean, that could happen. Right now, the trajectory doesn't look like that's going to happen, but, it could happen.
Speaking of transportation, let's talk about IMO 2020 and the impact that may have on diesel prices. And for our listeners that may not be aware of this new regulation that goes into effect, ships plying the seas are going to have to use diesel fuel that only has about 0.5% sulfur content versus 3.5% today. Let's talk about the implications of what this might mean for diesel.
Yeah, so I've compared this to the implementation of the ultra-low sulfur diesel specifications in the U.S. in 2006. And what happened then is that, diesel on the roads had to have super low sulfur content. And if you look historically before that implementation, gasoline was almost always more expensive than diesel. And after that implementation of ultra-low sulfur diesel, diesel has been more expensive than gasoline. And if you look at like 10-year average before and after, retail gasoline was about 4 cents a gallon higher than retail diesel. And since, on average, diesel has been about 9 cents a gallon higher than gasoline. And I think that's what's going to happen again, as these marine shipping, you know, consumes a considerable amount of diesel. And that is the bottom of the barrel. That's diesel that doesn't have to be cleaned up so much. That's where the sulfur in high sulfur crudes ends up, and that is an outlet for it. And right now, there's a lot of speculation that there's not going to be enough supply to meet this market. And in any case, it's going to cost more to produce this fuel. So what I think you're going to see is diesel prices step up again at a higher premium over gasoline. And I think that's what we're looking at. And we're probably looking at low sulfur crude oils developing a higher premium over high sulfur crude oils. And so that's good for shale oil. It's not so good for some of the high sulfur crudes around the world.
And let's talk about high sulfur crudes, because you had in Alberta, they were cutting back production. You've got a drop in production in Venezuela. And then, of course, you have OPEC cutting back production. Are we going to see various price differences as we do right now between WTI and Brent? Will we also see that between heavy crude and light crude?
Yeah, we probably will. I think the biggest difference is going to be, though, rather than heavy light, it's going to be, does it have sulfur or does it not have sulfur? What's the sulfur premium is going to get higher as we approach this IMO 2020 rule. A lot of refineries are perfectly capable of dealing with this, the sulfur, but it takes hundreds of millions of dollars in investments, and it takes years for these investments to pay out. So refineries are investing. And generally, when they invest for a high sulfur crude, they'll invest for a heavy crude. I used to work at a high sulfur, heavy crude refinery, and the economics of those crudes are very attractive because, you can take pretty, low quality oil and turn a barrel into just as much finished products as you can a light barrel of oil. It's just that the investments required to do that are higher. but the differentials between that price, the barrel of oil and the finished products is much, much larger because those crudes tend to sell at a significant discount to the good stuff. And when I was working in a refinery in Montana, often we had offers of Syncrude, and that's a very high quality crude. And if you look at the economics of it, you go, well, we would never do that because we have made the investments to deal with the heavy, you know, sour crudes. And so that's what we always stuck with. That was the best economics for us.
Well, let's turn our attention in terms of this rise in oil prices, what this means for investors. If we take a look at ETFs, popular ETFs like XLE, Robert, they're lower today than where they were at the beginning of last year. As an investor, what would you be doing? In other words, if you're looking at the sectors, given where the price of oil is, we've got IMO 2020, where would you be putting money?
So I've just written an article. I don't know if you recall the past few interviews we've done, I have been beating the table saying the pipeline companies are undervalued. I mean, they are ridiculously undervalued. And over the last month, we've finally seen a large jump in the pipeline companies. And I've just written an article for Investing Daily where I've looked at the performance over the last month. And you've got TransCanada up 15%. You've got Pembina Pipeline up 13%. Enterprise Products Partners is up 13%. Magellan Midstream Partners is up more than 10%. So the pipeline companies are finally making a move. I think they'll continue. They continue to be pretty deeply undervalued. They should have never gone down the way they did when oil prices went down because they're cash flow is pretty stable and growing. And many of these companies have increased their distributions, for more than a decade through high oil prices, low oil prices, and yet they got punished by, the decline in oil prices. So I'd still look to the midstreams, although they're not quite as deep a value as they were a month ago. Some of the refiners had gotten ridiculously undervalued. I made a recommendation to some of my subscribers to add Valero in early December, and it's jumped 15% in the last month because it had really gotten sort of ridiculously undervalued. Some of the, I'd say Shell, given the moves that they've made, is still really undervalued. They are well positioned for a sort of renewable natural gas, the synergies that those two bring, especially in the power sector. There are a lot of places that I would be looking. If you want a little more volatility, if you want to accept a little more volatility and maybe a little bit higher returns, a lot of the smaller oil companies, although something like a Diamondback has bounced back substantially now over the last month from its deep decline. A lot of these guys went down with oil prices, and they've had significant bounce back as oil prices have risen over the last month.
Final question. If you take a look at the junk bond market itself, a lot of those bonds are energy-related bonds. And the great thing for these companies is they were able to roll over that debt, get financed when interest rates were low. Now that we have credit spreads starting to widen, liquidity is drying up somewhat. What risk does that pose to the energy sector, especially if prices, let's say, don't rise and they remain low as they are today?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question right there is, I think the credit tightening a little bit, it hasn't tightened so much that it's it comes close to the impact of oil prices. So, if oil prices remain in this area, if they increase a little bit, as I think they will, I don't think that credit situation is going to hurt these guys. If we return, if we grant waivers again to Iran, if there's regime change in Venezuela that's suddenly friendly to the U.S. and they start to rebuild their oil industry, it is very bearish for oil prices. And then you will see some of those guys in a lot of trouble that have, the high yield credit.
So, Robert, as we close, you write at various publications for Investors Business Daily and Forbes. If our listeners would like to follow your work or find out more about your investment newsletter, tell them how they can do so, please.
Sure. So for Forbes, I write 7 monthly columns, and usually a Monday, Thursday, you can find a new column for me in Forbes under the energy segment. And then I write a couple of columns a week for Investing Daily, and I write a column, a subscription newsletter called Utility Forecaster, which is not just utilities, but it's income, investments, We've got pipeline companies. We've got integrated oil and gas. I've added Valero to that portfolio a month ago. And so that's where you'll find my investment advice. Forbes is just sort of a general, I'm going to write an article right now about potential regime change in Venezuela. And that has some investment implications, but for specific investment advice, that's at Investing Daily.
All right, Robert, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. So summing it up, you expect we could see $70 oil prices this year if all things go well.
Yeah, if OPEC sticks to the plan and Russia cooperates and we don't give, you know, if everything works right, I think we'll see $70 oil. But there are several potential problems that could arise that could prevent that from happening.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Robert.
You bet. Anytime.
And in hour two, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss the approaching debt tsunami. We received an email from a listener that asked about triple B bonds and what would happen to individual bondholders if those bonds were to be downgraded. So we'll take some time in hour two to discuss the consequences of that happening. We also talk about the leveraged loan market, since it too has exploded, doubling in size over the past decade. We also spend time discussing credit default swaps and what we see happening with global synchronization. So be sure to stay tuned for hour two, The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.